Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, latest chapter of Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, the rock chick writer extraordinaire. Ms. Jones, how are we this fine day?
Yeah, cool.
Cool is right. Yeah. Finally, autumn's arrived.
It has. Yeah, I always have a thing that I won't put the heating on until the 1st of October.
You're right.
You know, just the whole global warming thing, and it just feels a bit immoral. But there is a kind of crisp in the air at night now, isn't there?
Yes, there is a crisp in the air at night, and I wouldn't know how to stop my central heating. Come on, because it's all on a thermometer or something? Something that
switches. A thermostat.
Thermostat, that's the word. Thank you very much. And I don't know whether.
You've got to turn it down in your own apartment.
Well, I don't know how to do that. I wouldn't know how to do it.
So you've had it on full all summer?
No, it regulates itself according to the outside temperature.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, and it comes on, it goes off and that kind of stuff. I never have to turn it up or down or anything. It just does it itself. But talking about that, by the way, talking about the fact that we're now into autumn, and of course the highlight of autumn is often bonfire night, Guido forks, gunpowder plot and all that kind of stuff. I notice that in the corner of England in which you live, said to be one of London's poshest suburbs, and I'm talking here about Dulwich, the burghers of Dulwich have decided to scrap the annual bonfire party this year and replace it with a screen with a picture of a bonfire burning on it to save the planet. Has madness finally reached even where you live, Leslie Ann?
Well, maybe. I don't live there anymore, as I've told you multiple times. Oh, so you weren't listening. I moved out of Dulwich about 6 months ago.
Oh, but you used to live there for a long time. You were a member of the...
21 years, yes. I was, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't live there anymore, but I live in a part of London now which is famed for its annual bonfire party. It's said that 100,000 people descend on Blackheath for the celebrations, the fireworks. I've got a roof terrace and I plan not to go down into the fray if they do actually hold it.
Yeah.
Because there's some talk about they might not even have the bonfire party this year. Yeah. But I plan to invite my friends and to have a roof terrace party and watch it all from up there.
That is brilliant. Well done. Hot toddies and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? In the crisp November air, you know, woolly scarves wrapped around your neck and all that. That's what I like getting to from autumn into winter. But anyway, the hot sausages, that's right. Yeah, you'd have to bring a sausage into the conversation, of course, Miss Jones.
What's wrong with saying sausage?
You eat sausage. Oh, well, come on. You're famous for your double entendres, you know. You don't have to hide them. Goodness gracious. Anyway, talking about double entendres.
Entendres.
Yeah, there's been plenty of those in the Bond films over the years. And, of course, we're in the first 24 hours of the latest Bond film being released and millions flocking to the cinema to get an early eyeful of the 2-hour and 40-minute long No Time to Die. Will you be amongst that number, Miss Jones?
I think I'll probably get around to seeing it. You know, I'm not one of these people who's desperate to see the new Bond as soon as it comes out. A number of my friends on Twitter were saying, oh, I wish I was at the premiere tonight. I would have given anything to be there. And I thought, well, I wouldn't. It's just another film. Yeah. Come on.
It is very iconic. I feel quite proud about it, actually, because, you know, certain countries stand for certain things. So, for instance, Australia, I always think it stands for, obviously, kangaroos, but it's cricket. You know, Australia stands for its way of life and all that kind of thing. One of the great things about this country, apart from the royal family and apart from the fact that we had Winston Churchill, is James Bond, without a shadow of a doubt. James Bond is to Britain what Elvis was to the United States.
No, not exactly, no. And I think we've got to be a little bit careful with this nowadays because James Bond has always been a sexist pig and terribly promiscuous and predatory. Mm-hmm. And from what I've read, they've had to tone down those elements of his personality in this new film because of the Me Too movement.
Yes.
So, you know, they brought back a girlfriend instead of having him dump yet another one. Mm. So at least they're moving in the right direction. But maybe Daniel Craig is stepping down because he sees that the character of Bond is no longer relevant in this part of the 21st century. You know, we've moved on from that. It's a horribly sexist character. And also, glorifying the killing of people. Is it really what we want to be watching nowadays?
Well, you know, plenty of creative art glorifies the killing of people. Peaky Blinders, you know, loads of franchises of films in the past. So I can't say that's a big problem. I agree with the sexism, of course I do. I was astonished even as a young man in, Goldfinger, when Bond, then played by Sean Connery, is on the terrace of that very famous hotel on Miami Beach. I'm sure you'll have been there. I have. It's called the, begins with L, I think.
You mean the Breakers?
No, something else.
Kind of big, famous, old one. I've stayed there.
Yeah, well, Miami Beach is like a strip, isn't it? A sand between the sort of the coast and the sea.
Most beaches are a strip of sand, funnily enough.
Yeah, but this is like an island. That's what I mean, Miami Beach. But anyway, and I remember Felix Leiter comes along, the CIA agent, and Bond is being massaged by this, you know, another beautiful woman. And Felix comes along, and then Bond gets up and says to the girl, right, we've got men's talk now. Just run along, young lady, and go and get yourself a martini or something, and smacks her on the bottom, you know. And, of course, that would be sexual assault these days. We've seen many cases of women actually taking cases against men for slapping their bottoms, quite rightly, you know. So I totally agree with that. But I hope it hasn't gone too far the other way and it's all a bit sort of, you know, staid and lacking in sort of humour and chemistry. You can still have sexual chemistry without having sexism.
You can have sexual chemistry without ever laying a finger on somebody.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. But I hope they don't get rid of all that, you know. But anyway, there we are. Talking about that, by the way, talking about work, and of course you are a very, very hard-working individual, Miss Jones. I think you work every day. And that interests me because you're also a church warden, are you not, at St. Bride's in Fleet Street?
I am very proudly a church warden of St. Bride's in Fleet Street, yes.
Of course you are. Now, that guy, the big tall guy who's the breakfast presenter on the BBC, Dan somebody, what's his name? Dan?
Don't know, don't watch it.
Yeah, Dan Walker, okay?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He's quite a young guy, isn't he?
Quite a young guy, very tall, and he works with, Naga Munchetti, I think, the lady who works with him.
Oh, I know who you mean, yes.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But anyway, he's now on Strictly Come Dancing, okay? And it's caused a little bit of a problem, although I'm not saying it's a problem, I'm saying it's a principle, that he will not practice on Sundays because he too is a church follower and believes that the Sabbath is a day of rest. And I wonder what your attitude to that would be, yourself being a worshipper in church.
Well, I obviously do attend church services on Sundays.
Yeah.
I'm not going to preach or lay down the law here. I think one has to be relaxed about it and allow for choice. The important thing is not to judge.
Yeah.
Who are we to judge? If somebody else wants to go and do something particular on a Sunday, that's, you know, it's fine, isn't it? It's up to them. My personal choice is to attend church on Sundays, but I'm not going to say to anybody else, you have to as well, because that's what I do.
Yeah.
So I think, yes, you've got to live and let live, really, haven't you? People go to church for all kinds of reasons on other days of the week as well.
Yes.
You know, we have a very full week of events at St. Bride's. We have memorial services, funerals, weddings, christenings, and all these things are happening on different days of the week, not just Sundays.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, people are not Christians only on Sundays.
No, I totally agree. I'm a Christian.
7 days a week.
Yeah, I'm a Christian. I don't go to church often enough, but I live a Christian way of life. I try to make my life, you know, go along the lines of what I believe to be Christian beliefs. But as you quite rightly say, each to their own. I'm certain that your faith would not stop you downing a couple of large gin and tonics in the Cheshire Cheese if I ever invited you there for lunch after a Sunday service.
Absolutely not. And in fact, we do serve wine and champagne and so on at the back of church.
Really?
The end of service is a very sociable thing to do.
Brilliant.
At the moment, everybody takes their glass and moves outside into the churchyard.
Yeah.
But we have some very convivial gatherings.
But yeah,
You'd be very welcome to attend, Mike.
Yeah, sounds great. Yeah, well, I must put that in my diary because that sounds wonderful. A bit of worship followed by a bit of the old blatteration. Yes, sounds brilliant. Now, what are we going to talk to you about? Yeah, I was going to talk to you about the fact that I had the extreme honour and pleasure of meeting one of your favourite showbiz friends the other night, Mike Batt. I was in a TV studio in the green room waiting to go on the set. I was doing a three-hour show, and one of the guests within the show was going to be Mike Batt. And as I walked in, this chap was sitting there, and I sort of thought, I'm sure I recognise him. I'm sure, who's that guy? And then as soon as he started talking, I realised it was Mike Batt. So I went up and introduced myself as your good friend, and he was, you know, very warm about it and said, oh, wonderful, how is Leslie Ann, all that kind of stuff. And then I started talking to Mike Batt, and I must have talked to him about 15 minutes, and it's the most engaging conversation I've had with a member of the showbiz fraternity for a long time. I could not believe I was sitting there face-to-face talking to the man who wrote Bright Eyes.
He's a wonderful person. He's one of my favourite people, actually.
Yeah.
Multiple talented. You know, it's not just about, I say just, about songwriting, but he's also an incredible singer. I kind of lost track of the number of songs he'd recorded himself, actually.
Yes.
And then he brought an album out. I think it's about a year or 2 years ago now, of all his own songs. Mm. He also wrote this incredible musical called The Men Who March Away. I think we spoke about it before.
We have. I can't remember what it was about. What was it about?
It's a personal take on three wars.
Oh, yeah.
So the First World War, the Spanish Civil War, and obviously the Second World War.
Yeah.
It's astonishing. It's brilliant. It has amazing songs. It needs to be staged.
Golly.
I went to a sort of showcase of it where they did a supported version with actors singing and performing the roles and so on.
Mm.
I thought, you know, I've seen some rubbish on the West End stage, but this would knock them all into a cocked hat.
Yeah,
well, and Mike couldn't give it away. So I wish him well, because he is another one who works tremendously hard.
Yeah.
And the mistake he made, do you remember his artist, Katie Melua?
Yes.
I knew Katie a bit because she was at the Brit School with my
daughter. There are 9 million bicycles in Beijing.
Is that one of hers?
Yeah, he wrote it for her. He told me.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that song.
Yeah.
But he kind of bet the farm on Katie.
Right.
He did 10 albums with her, but he personally bankrolled her efforts to become a superstar in America.
Really?
And she didn't break America. And I think Mike suffered huge personal loss because of that.
Really?
And there is a thing, isn't there, that you never bet the farm. You never put your own money, in other words, into a professional project.
Yes.
Because it can so easily go wrong.
That's right.
And now they're not together anymore. She's gone off. You don't hear a lot about Katie Melua anymore.
No, no.
I really wish Mike well, because he's somebody with a tremendously good heart, always willing to help other people.
Yeah.
He also co-wrote with Tim Rice, actually, the David Essex hit, A Winter's Tale. Do you remember that song?
Yeah. Well, didn't he co-write Phantom of the Opera with Lloyd Webber?
Yeah, he did. And he was the one who cast Steve Harley of Cockney Rebel.
Yes.
In the singing of that song.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Oh, he actually thought he was going to get the role. And, of course, eventually they put, Michael Fing.
Michael Crawford.
Frank Spencer, yes.
Yeah, Michael Crawford, yeah.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. And I think Steve thought he was going to get the role because he got the song.
Yeah.
So that was a shame.
But I
wish Mike well in absolutely everything. He and his wife, Julianne, they're fantastic people.
I mean, everything he told me was so fascinating. He said he got a call from Lloyd Webber saying, I've got half a song here, Mike, and I can't get it over the line. Come over and see me, will you? I need somebody to play a few chords on a piano or something like that. And together they came out with Phantom of the Opera. But that song, that one, there are 9 million bicycles, he was on a bus in China with Katie Melua, or whatever her name is. Is it Melua or Melhua?
Melua.
Melua, yeah, Katie Melua.
She's Georgian, from that, you know, the kind of former Soviet state of Georgia.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And they're on the and Katie actually was sitting in a window seat and saw all these people on bikes in Beijing. And she actually asked the guide that they were with, how many bicycles are there in Beijing? And the guide answered 9 million. And Mike heard this and it immediately triggered, you know, the thought to write a song. I mean, so brilliant. You couldn't believe it, could you?
I think a lot of songs are conjured like that.
Yes.
You know, that reminds me of 99 Red Balloons. Do you remember that one?
Yes, I do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 99 Red Balloons.
Lots of songs are conjured by just little snippets of things.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, Ringo Starr takes credit for some of the Beatles' most famous songs. A Hard Day's Night, that was an expression I think he made to a taxi driver. 8 days a week, I think, was another one he made. And he used to come
out. Tomorrow Never Knows.
Tomorrow Never Knows, is that right? Good.
Yeah, because he came out with, his brain kind of didn't quite work in the conventional way.
Absolutely right.
He'd mean to say something and something else would come out of his mouth.
Yes, no, I think you're absolutely right. And then John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
Is that ringing any bells, Mike?
Ringing the bells for me, you mean? Well, most of the stuff that comes at my mouth out of my mouth doesn't make sense these days, but that's another story altogether, Miss Jones. Listen, I'll tell you what I was going to talk to you about just on that, just before we get off that. There's a book out, and I've just read a review of it. It's called 1962. Apparently, it was the year that changed the world, you know, because everything that triggered, you know, the 60s and the revolution and put the war behind us happened then. But one thing I did not realise was that on exactly the same day, 1962, the first Beatles song, Love, Love Me Do, was released at the same moment as the first Bond film, Dr. No. What an amazing coincidence, eh?
Do you think so? I mean, it doesn't seem that much of a coincidence to me. Just
that it must be me. The first ever Bond film, the first ever Bond film, and the first ever Beatles single released at midday on the same day in 1962.
Well, quite a lot of things happened that year. So we had the launch of the polio vaccine, for example.
Really? Didn't know
we
that.
Had the first men in space.
First man in space. Yuri Gagarin, yeah.
We had the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Cuban Missile Crisis, yes. I remember that one.
And Brazil beat Czechoslovakia to win the World Cup.
With a 17-year-old Pelé in the starting lineup.
There you go. And we had, this is the most important example of things that happened in 1962,
yeah.
The first ever flavoured crisps were sold.
Oh, no.
What? And guess what the flavour was?
I think it was, I'm going to go either or. It was either cheese and onion or smoky bacon. I will go cheese and onion.
No, it was salt and vinegar.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So 1962 was a very significant year. Yeah. It was also the year that Marilyn Monroe sang Happy Birthday to President John Kennedy. An iconic moment, wasn't it? Adding to rumours that,
yes, it was, yeah.
That they were, at least you know the words to that one.
Yes.
They were, you know, there were all those rumours that they were having an affair.
Yeah. That was the occasion in which that dress she was wearing was actually stitched onto her body. It was that tight. Do you remember?
It looked like it was sprayed on from the picture.
It did, yeah, it did. But it was stitched on. The dressmakers just pulled it tight at the side and then stitched it onto her and had to unstitch it for her to get it off. Oh, well. That's,
As opposed to getting it on.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, but the scandal about that, of course, was that 3 months later she was found dead in suspicious circumstances.
Very
and
suspicious.
That's another death that they've never resolved.
Never resolved, indeed. You're absolutely right. Talking about famous women and stars and all that kind of stuff, did you see that piece about Linda Evangelista, one of the most beautiful and famous models of the last 20, 30, 40 years? She had something called cool sculpting done to her face. And she's turned out to be like, you know, the Elephant Woman.
It's, it's tragic, isn't it? The pictures are just awful because she was so stunningly beautiful.
Yeah.
But I'd have to say it's because she was such a beautiful woman that she did this to her face. Because when the tools of your trade begin to fade,
yeah.
And in her case, the tools of your trade are your face,
yeah.
Which is your fortune,
yeah.
when that begins to go, it's much worse than for the rest of us. That's when desperation sets in, and they will try anything.
Yeah.
To try and regain some of their youthful, exquisite beauty. But it's a hiding to nothing because aging is aging. It happens to us all and there's nothing you can do about it.
Can you explain to our millions of listeners, please, Miss Jones, what exactly is cool sculpting?
Well, I don't know exactly because I never would do something like this myself. It's a semi-surgical procedure in which they go in with needles, they heat up the fat, the subcutaneous fat, so it's under the top layers of your skin.
Right.
They heat up that fat layer, and then they shift it around, and then they cool it down again, so that you know it's a way of sculpting the fat that's underneath your skin.
Yeah, is it designed to remove skin from sort of under your mouth? If you see what I mean, between.
Yeah, it kind of reshapes it all. It drags it all up again so that you get a crisp jawline again.
Gosh, that's really shocking, isn't it?
I tell you who else has it. You know that columnist on the Saturday Mail, Amanda...
Oh, Platel, yes.
She's had it, and she swears by it.
Right.
She says she will never stop having it.
Right.
But I mean, no disrespect to Amanda Platel, but she was no Evangelista in the first place.
Oh, it's a bit harsh, isn't it?
No, because I'm
another fellow woman journalist. Not at all.
No. I would say exactly the same about myself. Ah. Neither of us was Linda Evangelista, put it that way.
Mm.
So if you have less beauty,
well, I think you're a lot closer, to be honest, Miss Jones. I think everybody will accept that, you know. Yes.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Yes. Well, I think if you're a raving beauty to begin with, you've got much more to lose. Mm. Look at people like Britt Eklund.
Yeah.
Who, you know, I think she's 80 something now, Britt Eklund.
Yes, she is. Yeah.
And 80. She's had all kinds of surgical procedures done. Mm. It looks ridiculous. You can't get it back.
Mm.
Whatever it was that you had, you know, it's a mixed blessing, beauty, isn't it?
Oh yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I'd never have it done, but then I haven't got any vanity about my looks. I've always regarded myself as, you know, just an average looking Joe. And when I look in the mirror these days, I just shrug my shoulders. Honestly, I'm not going to get a hair transplant. I'm not going to try and, you know, have bits carved off my face or anything like that. People have got to take me as I am. And anyway, the only thing I really worry about these days is getting up in the morning, going to bed at night. You know what I mean?
Well, health is obviously the most important thing. But we all have to get our heads around aging. It's a normal thing.
Yeah.
Why are we so anti-aging? I don't get it. I know it's a huge cosmetic industry that generates billions, and that probably is the reason. And this hooks into women's insecurity, and to some extent these days as well, into men's insecurity.
Yes.
Men are now wearing makeup and having surgical procedures and having hair transplants, as you mentioned.
Yeah, sure.
My mother said to me recently, why didn't Prince William have a hair transplant when he started to lose his hair?
Yeah.
Well, it would be ridiculous. And actually, that is vanity beyond, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think we would find it ridiculous
if our heir to the throne
started messing around with his looks.
I totally agree. Wayne Rooney had a hair transplant, but he was a very young man. He was in his mid-20s, 24, 25. And it kind of worked for a while, and then it just sort of faded again. And now I think he's just left it alone. And, you know, you can understand why. Isn't it sad to have read again about the loss of another member of the 66th World Cup squad, Roger Hunt? And morbidly, I'm afraid, the newspaper reports that followed, you know, it all got down, and now there are three, you know what I mean? And it's awful, isn't it, having a countdown to the number of 66 World Cup heroes still left alive.
Do you know what it reminded me of each year when Remembrance Sunday comes around?
Yes.
You see the old guys with their medals in their wheelchairs. You know, didn't the last one die last year or something? The last survivor from the First World War, maybe?
I think so, something like that, yes.
Or would it be the Second World War?
I think it could have been an extraordinary age, about 104 or something like that, yeah.
Each year would come around and it would be, oh, yes, there are only, you know, five left or whatever. And that must feel like having an axe dangling over your head, mustn't it?
Yeah, no, it must, when you look at it like that. I remember Roger Hunt so well. He played for Liverpool and Liverpool-Everton rivalry in the 60s at its height. The start of the 1966 football season, Ray Wilson, who was England's left-back and an Everton player, and Roger Hunt, who was inside forward for England and a Liverpool player, ran around Goodison Park clutching the Jules Rimet World Cup trophy because they'd both played in the winning team. A lovely guy, Roger Hunt. Met him at a few dinners over the years, you know, and very easygoing sort of a guy. And the story that people should tell more often is that Roger Hunt was standing 2 feet away from the goal line when Jeff Hurst shot cannon down off the underside of the crossbar, the famous, most famously disputed goal of all time. Did it cross the line? It was 2-2 at the time, in extra time. Jeff Hurst crashes the ball in off the underside of the bar. The ref eventually gives a goal for 3-2. But Roger Hunt was standing 2 feet away. And he said many times, but people don't often realise this, of course the goal was over the line. I saw it go over the line. If it hadn't gone over the line, I'd have moved forward on it and put it over the line. But it had already gone in. And people don't take enough notice of that.
Yeah, it's very true. I was just thinking. So we've got Jeff Hurst left. We've got George Cohen. Who's the other one?
Bobby Charlton.
Okay, I always forget him.
But sadly, Bobby Charlton has...
Well, he's not really with us, is he, anymore? That's the thing.
He's come out into the open, so we're not discussing his health, you know, behind his back. He's admitted that he's having a struggle with dementia and working on it. Jeff Hurst is completely compos mentis. I think I've seen Jeff within the last 12 months, and I'm always amazed. He's getting up towards 80. I think he's 79. Always amazed how bright and lively and clear-thinking Jeff Hurst is. You know George Cohen better than most. And George Cohen, I think, is also struggling a bit, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. I last saw him, actually, at my dad's funeral.
Yes,
exactly. And he was in a little walker thing. Yeah. It was his 80th birthday that day.
Golly.
And a bizarre thing took place. Norman Giller, the journalist started up a round of singing happy birthday to George Cohen in the chapel where my dad's coffin was, sitting right there. It was a strange moment, actually.
Yeah,
I wasn't sure it was entirely appropriate, but I would never hurt someone's feelings by actually telling them that.
No, of course not, no. Okay, everybody, welcome back to Life on Planet Porky, and good to have you with us. Ms. Jones, we've sort of ratcheted down our work schedules, and we're now producing one Life on Planet Porky a week. And I have to say how overwhelmed and pleased I am by the response we've got to this. People saying it was lovely to have two. Now we've got one very high quality one episode of Life on Planet Porky a week is suffice to get them through the weekend, because it comes out, of course, every Friday morning.
It's the tension thing, Mike. Creative tension is all, isn't it?
Yeah.
Keep them waiting.
Oh, well,
keep
we don't
them
like
wanting
it.
More. Yeah, no, I think it's great. It works. Yeah. I think it works very well for a Friday morning, yes.
Yes, of course it does. And then people see it all, listen to it all over the weekend, leisure time and all that kind of stuff. Now, somebody who's not going to be having a very good weekend this weekend, unfortunately, is Ms. Katie Price. This woman's life is literally a car crash, and that's not a pun. That is, in fact, a fact, because she's hit the headlines, of course, in the last 48 hours for a car crash. She rolled her car over at 6 a.m. in the morning, allegedly under the influence of drink and drugs, whilst driving without a driving license because of a previous ban. I think she's had 6 driving bans in all. But what amazed me most remarkably was that the day before this happened, I actually saw her on Breakfast TV in the studio, GMB, and it was the first time she'd ever been interviewed with her sister, who was a perfectly normal, you know, sort of middle-aged, middle-class sort of a woman, as different from Katie Price as you can be. And yet, 24 hours later, she's rolling around in a car in a wreck without a seatbelt on. And this is a woman who has huge responsibilities to her disabled, a terribly disabled son. And I would have thought she'd take more care of herself, really.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's first of all, what was the hook to the interview? Why were they sitting there being interviewed on GMB?
It was amazing. It was just because this is the first time her sister's ever agreed to come on television and be interviewed with her. That was the hook for the interview.
So just to say, look how different I am from my sister.
Sort of, yeah. They were sort of taking it. I couldn't quite understand the purpose of the interview, to be honest.
Oh, very weird. I've never understood the whole Katie Price caper. Anyway.
No, I haven't either.
I think perhaps she was an ordinary girl from nowhere who dared, wasn't she?
What for those?
And she rose to the top. She injected her breasts with implants, appealing to the lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
She didn't even write her own novels. They were ghosted.
Yeah.
I find her, and I don't mean to be unkind, because she is a fantastic, or is she? We've seen a documentary that says what a fantastic mother she has been to poor Harvey, her disabled son.
Yeah.
But were she a fantastic mother, would she be in her car, driving on a ban and rolling her car, risking her life? And she's got all those other children as well.
Yes, she has,
And you're right, her whole life has been a car crash.
Yeah.
So what happens now? Does she go to prison for this latest misdemeanor? In which case, who looks after the kids?
Well, it's absolutely right. I mean, the level of irresponsibility. I think, oh, she's under the influence, she's an addict and all that. No. We've talked about this before. Jimmy Greaves was an addict. He managed to straighten his life up for the last 43 years of his life. If you've got the willpower and the determination and you want to do it, you can do it. You can get yourself on the straight and narrow, particularly if there are children who are dependent on you, and particularly children who are as vulnerable as Harvey. she, I think I'm right in saying, made her first million when your friend and, you know, my friend as well, but more your friend, Mr. John Blake, gave her £1 million to publish her first life story.
Yes. Yes, he did.
I think she's written that book about four times since. I think she's had about four life stories, hasn't she?
I think they both did very well out of it. And, you know, we know John. John's a fantastic entrepreneur. And indeed, he saw a moment and he went for it. Yeah. Because there were people out there who would never read a book.
Yes.
Who read Katie Price's book.
You're right.
So
about
you have
that.
To say, from the point of view of the book publishing industry, that was a good thing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. You're absolutely right. And she sold book after book after book. And you're quite right. I don't think it was John, was it, who suddenly came up with the idea of somebody writing novels and then putting Katie Price's name on it. But that was another winner, wasn't it?
Yeah, I thought that was his, actually.
Oh, it probably was. It probably was, Johnny. Very clever boys. You're quite right.
Extremely clever man, yes. Yeah.
And talking about old friends from the world of Fleet Street, how come is it about every 6 months I open the newspaper, on this occasion the Daily Mail, and I see the bright beaming face of David Wigg staring out at me, the big interview, and this time with Robin John Gibb, who was, of course, Robin Gibb's son, and quite a remarkable story.
Well, is it really? I mean, what this story is another tale of a son of, or a daughter of, in this case, a son, yeah, of a famous rock superstar who is trying to generate a career. So Robin Gibb died back in May 2012. That's
yes,
a long time ago.
Yes.
And his son, that they call RJ, Robin John Gibb, is going out on tour next year, singing his own songs and some Bee Gees hits and all that. It's a massive puff piece. This guy is 38.
Yeah.
He hasn't got a hope in hell of having a rock career himself. Mm-hmm. He's a father of three, or I think he's got a stepdaughter as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's he's trying to make a career on the back of his father's superstardom. And we've heard this story so many times before.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder why the Mail keep falling for it.
Well, do you know what? I think that's a bit harsh. I mean, I know you are a master of all things rock and roll, and you are literally an expert in the genre, an expert in the industry. But I kind of got the feeling, maybe Wiggy's just very good at bending it this way, that the son was doing it as a tribute to his father, to keep his father's music alive, to spread the word of the father he's so terribly proud of and to whom he was so close during his life.
Well, call me an old cynic, but I do disagree. I mean, staying alive, right? That music is alive. It doesn't need the boost.
Yeah.
We hear Bee Gees hits on the radio all the time.
Yeah,
they haven't gone away.
Yeah, I agree.
It doesn't really need that boost from this kid who's trying to have a career.
Yeah.
Sorry to sound cynical, but I think you'll find that that's what it's really about. David Wigg is very good at this, you know, and he has, to be fair, he was friends with Robin Gibb and his wife Dweena for many, many years.
Yeah.
David always had these niches. He had one with Freddie Mercury.
Yes.
So whenever Freddie was, you know, Queen had to go out on tour, they had a new album coming out, the tours were always about supporting the albums. So Freddie would be required to do an interview with someone.
Yeah.
It would always be David Wigg.
Yeah, sure.
Because he was the journalist he could trust. And David has these ins with a certain number of people, and they go back many years.
Yeah.
And he's nurtured. Also, Cliff Richard always comes to David Wigg.
Right.
So, you know, you've got to hand it to Wiggy, really, for having maintained these niches and these friendships.
Yeah.
And he never writes anything unpleasant.
Yeah.
I remember when he went to the premiere of Bohemian Rhapsody, the Queen film, and he raved about it in print. He said nothing about all the errors in that film and all the shortcuts and all the invented characters and the fact that it's kind of semi-true.
Yeah.
No, not a documentary by any means, but he didn't say one negative thing about it.
Yeah.
And that has been David's shtick all these years, is that he doesn't write negative things.
No, I know he doesn't. No, I know. I think I've told this story before, even on this podcast, but when I was the news editor at the Express once, I got David went to some pop awards, and I told him to ring me from the venue, because it wasn't going to finish till about sort of 4 o'clock, and let me know if there's anything I could put on the evening news schedule, you know, a conference. The evening conference was usually at 4:30. Yep. So I said, Wiggy, whatever you do, give me a call. I said, I want to know what the big showbiz story of the day is. Anyway, he duly rang because he wasn't a great drinker, David, like a lot of people who would have gone there and just got completely pissed, you know. And he said, no, nothing happened. And he gave me some bum story about, I don't know, I can't even remember what it was. It was so poor. Only for me to find out much later on, about 6:30 or 7, that George Michael had been completely pissed at this dude, got up on stage, started shouting and swearing, you know, abusing people. It was the first time George Michael revealed the other side of his character, you know, taking drugs and drink and all that. But Wiggy was too kind to one of his friends to tell me.
Yeah, there was another occasion when Princess Michael of Kent was at one of those award ceremonies. I think it was at the Grosvenor House, and it would have been the Nord of Robin Silver Clef lunch. It's an annual do sort of fundraiser for the music business charity. Mm. And she made a remark in her address about drink and drugs and exciting things like that. Mm. And of course, all the press ears in the room pricked up and we all rushed off to the bank of phones out in the foyer, pre-mobile phones this was.
Yes.
And Phil Collins came out and found us all on the phones to our copy desks.
Yeah.
And he tore us off a strip. You disgusting creatures, you know, she didn't realise what she was saying. Mm. English isn't her first language and you're all going to send her up in the papers tomorrow. Wiggy having a go at us. And Wiggy was nowhere to be seen. There was no way on the planet that Wiggy would have filed that story.
Good God. Oh, that makes sense. That was certainly my experience. Talking about premieres and all that kind of stuff, and of course we've already mentioned James Bond in this podcast once, but the race is now on for the new James Bond, right? And one of the contenders is Tom Hiddleston. You know, you won't probably know Tom Hiddleston. He was in a thing called The Night Manager with Hugh Laurie. It was a very, very good TV adaptation. He's one of the favourites. You'd recognise him if I could show you a picture of him. But the reason I mention this is that I've read a story saying that the guy charges £225 to have a photograph taken with him when he goes to First Nights. And he's going to...
That's cheap, isn't it?
Yeah. And he's going to, what's this, taking... Next up, MCM Comic Con in London. Does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, it's a big one of those conventions of people who follow comic strip characters.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Things like Spider-Man and stuff.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay, right, fine. So he's going to this and he's announced already that fans who want their picture taken with him can have it done for £225. I think that is absolutely bloody awful, honestly.
Wasn't this the guy who was Taylor Swift's boyfriend?
Yes, that's right. Exactly. I'm sure, you know, it looked like a publicity stunt, hopping on and off her plane, flying across America and all that. You know what I mean?
Well, this is scraping the barrel, isn't it?
Oh, it's terrible.
He doesn't deserve to be James Bond because he's got no class.
No, I think that's awful. Now, when I used to do live stage shows, I used to do it in a duo called the Two Mics, right? And we organised most of it all ourselves until they started getting too big. You know, the shows were too big. Thousands of people rather than hundreds. And they were
Weren't you paying them to have their photo taken with you?
I'm about to say to you. And you know, we had to take on a promoter, or a promoter took us on to organise everything, because, you know, you can't just put a show on at the O2 in Shepherd's Bush or the big theatre in Birmingham. Can't remember what it's called now. You have to go to it. But this promoter, to my astonishment, said, now, remember, lads, I want you up in the green room half an hour before we start. I said, no, we'll be in our dressing room then. No, come to the green room. I said, why? He said, oh, 50 people have paid an extra £35 on their ticket to have their picture taken with you. And I said, what? I said, I'm not doing that. I'm not charging the fans 35. No, you are. They've paid. You've got to do it. It's already paid because you buy the tickets electronically, you see. And when you're filling your, you know, all out on your laptop, you can tick a box. Do you wish to pay £35? Have your picture taken with the two mics. You see what I mean? And it was completely unbeknown to me. But the problem is that if 50 people want their picture taken, it takes an average of about, I don't know, a minute to step in, and that's 50 minutes. And so we couldn't, we only had half an hour. So I'm not joking. It was the most embarrassing episode of my life. This promoter was grabbing somebody, sticking them in front of us, picture, and then grabbing them by the shoulder and pulling them away again. You see what I mean?
Oh, dear. Because yeah, I can see why you would find that embarrassing.
You could only do it in, you could only give them 30 seconds each, otherwise we'd have been there all night. And it was horrible. Mm. And after the show, although it was a private party after the show, people always hang around. And so, you know, it might be an hour later, there were still people waiting around downstairs or waiting outside. And they'd come out and I said, yeah, I mean, you'd pose for pictures for nothing. You know what I mean? It was just dreadful. And the other one that there's a business now, you know, in people selling videos of birthday greetings or something like that. And I'm talking about big stars do it for £87.50 a time.
No, it's appalling. It's a bit like these sort of music packages where, say, somebody's playing a gig at the Pizza Express Hoban, which is quite a popular little venue for a supper gig.
Yes.
And I've seen quite a few people perform there. It's a good thing. But so you can pay your ticket price and go along and have your pizza and your bottle of wine and whatever else and see the show.
Yeah.
Or you can pay another price, which is height, and you get to go early, you get to sit in on the sound check, and you get to ask questions of the artist and all of this and step up and have a picture taken if you want to.
Yeah.
But you're paying about £200 for the privilege, so-called.
Oh.
I think there's something really grossly embarrassing about that.
Yeah, so do I. Honestly, I really do. It's just like you're squeezing a sponge, aren't you, to get every drop of money out of the fans, you know what I mean? I
think, or the promoter is, which is more to the point.
Well, exactly. No, you're absolutely right. You've probably never heard of a guy called Theo Pafitis, have you?
Yes, I've seen Dragon's Den.
Oh, Dragon's Den, that's right. And he was chairman of Millwall Football Club during their glory years. They got to the FA Cup final, which was in Cardiff that year because Wembley was being rebuilt. And he became a good friend, Theo. You know, used to get him onto the sports shows and all that kind of stuff. But also a brilliant businessman. He, I think it's Ryman's, the high street stationers. I think he, you know, bought that for nothing, turned it over and sold it for hundreds of millions of pounds and other businesses. But why I like him is because he's an incredibly cynical bloke, you know, as a lot of these people are. And I remember one time when I was in charge of TalkSport, we had a young fellow working there who actually wasn't very good, but he was bumptious and big-headed, and his dad was also some kind of a businessman, you know, and right little cocky fella. He went off once and tried to interview Prince William on the polo field with a handheld mic, you know what I mean, all this kind of stuff. But this guy, believe it or not, ended up going out with Theo's daughter. And when we were in the boardroom at Millwall once, he was chairman of Millwall, and Theo used to talk through his teeth. He said, "Hi, Mike, how you doing? Everything all right? Everything all right?" He's of Greek ancestry, as you can probably tell. And I said, "Yeah." He said, "How's that lad of yours? He's shagging my daughter." I said,
"You don't sound anything like the epiphany."
No, that's true. Yeah, and I said, "Oh, yeah," and it was a bit embarrassing. I said, "You mean young Rick?" He said, "No, I don't mean young Rick. I mean young Rick without the P." Ha 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 ha
ha! Oh dear! That's not a very nice thing to say about your daughter, though, is it?
No, he was absolutely dismissive about his daughter's boyfriend, you know. I mean, I don't think they were engaged to get married or anything, believe me, you know. But anyway, I can see that story does not amuse you, Miss Jones.
No, not really, no. Moving swiftly on.
What is it about the Cotswolds, Seth, that make us all think it's a fascinating place to go? Listen to this. The Highgrove Life, yours for £7.5 million, the Cotswold Estate with 117 acres, and Charles and Camilla as next door neighbours. It does seem to be the place to be if you want to be anybody.
Well, I've got some great friends who live in Tetbury, quite close to Highgrove.
Mm-hmm.
And they say the main reason they love it is because the security is so good. Nobody's ever going to burgle your house because the place is swarming with invisible security because of Charles and Camilla being there.
Really? Is that the case?
And so they feel very, very safe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I can imagine that. But it can't be the whole of the Cotswolds, can it? Because, I mean, there's an enclave where David Cameron lives, Jeremy Clarkson, Kate, what's her name, the very famous model?
Kate Moss.
Kate who?
Kate Moss.
Kate Moss, that's right, from Croydon. You're absolutely right, yeah. And it's just become so very, very popular, hasn't it? It is a beautiful part of the world, but for me, it's too dull. I used to go to Cheltenham year after year, and I'd always drive up there myself. And Cheltenham's a dreadful place to get to from Stockbroker Belt, Surrey. And you have to go around the M25, down the M4, then you have to come off the M4 at Swindon. And then you have to weave your way through, basically, the Cotswolds. And all these beautiful little villages, you know, Boughton on the Water and places like that. And
they're all in the world, yes. Yeah. It is lovely. I went up there quite recently.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was researching the life of Brian Jones.
Oh, yes, of course.
For my new book. I read this as well. I had no idea. My mother was horrified because my father used to go off to the races in Cheltenham every year.
Yes.
I'm not casting aspersions on my father by any means.
No.
But I read that the highest number of brothels anywhere in the UK is in Cheltenham.
Really?
Really.
I've seen stories over the years about residents complaining about yet another lap dancing club opening. I've seen all that going on, you know, and that might just be, I don't know, might just be the way the town's got it. I love Cheltenham because the whole town's dominated, obviously, by the racecourse. My sister went to she went to the Royal College, the College of Food and Domestic Arts in Birmingham. Then one of her first jobs was at Kraft, that's right, in Cheltenham. And she used to live in a place called Clarence Square. And I used to go around and see her because I was working in Birmingham, the Birmingham Mail. And we had some, you know, all our friends used to come along. And it was, it is a lovely place, lovely part of the world. I totally agree. Now then, Ms. Jones. Don't like to get serious in these podcasts, but seems once again the question mark of where did COVID come from has arisen. I've seen an Australian journalist, a lady called Sherry, Mertzen. Yeah, Mertzen, I'm reading my notes here. And she's writing another book saying that, you know, a lot of people who were involved in the release of that COVID-19, whether it came from a laboratory in Wuhan or it didn't, have suddenly gone on the disappeared list in China. We're never going to know the truth, are we?
Well, my question is, why is the world wasting billions of dollars, pounds, whatever, on this investigation? Because if we did ever find out how it started, how it emerged, how it was unleashed upon the world, what are we going to do about that?
Yeah.
We can't fine China. We can't make China disappear.
Yes.
They are a country in their own right, a huge influential country. We can't make them pay for that.
Mm.
So why are we wasting so much money on it? Why not spend that money instead on working on the vaccines, developing new treatments, and making the world a better place, rather than just trying to find out what happened?
Yeah, no,
because it can't lead to anything.
I totally agree with you. But I think the fear is the possibility that China was deliberately sort of engineering viruses inside that laboratory, which one day they may release right across the world as a most sophisticated form of chemical warfare?
Yeah, it's very, very possible and probably the case. But again, there's nothing we can do about it. You know, we can't boycott China because China has its tentacles into pretty much every country on the planet.
Yeah.
We're all using Chinese goods. Yeah. All of our mobile phones are made up of parts manufactured only in China.
Yeah.
So we're not in a position to boycott China as a planet.
Yeah.
Until we're in that position, I think we are just at the mercy of this territory. I don't know what else to say.
No, I think
it's highly likely that they will wipe us out eventually.
But, well, you know, that's a real doomsday type scenario, but you may well be right. If it's Iran and Iran are building a nuclear reactor, then we bomb it. You see what I mean? And try and get rid of it.
You can't bomb China, it's too big.
I was about to say, you can hardly bomb one sort of laboratory in the middle of China, can you? It wouldn't have any effect anyway. They've got plenty of other laboratories and all that kind of stuff. But no, I totally agree. Don't like to get into heavy stuff. Just want to finish talking about Lindsay Buckingham, one of the most famous musicians of my lifetime. I read a review of a new album he's brought out. I didn't know he was still doing it.
This is his seventh solo album, and he still can't give it away. He's, 71 now? He's just begun a new US tour. I remember being when I was working in Los Angeles back in the 80s,
yeah,
driving down Sunset Boulevard, and there would be vast hoardings of Lindsay Buckingham's face, gigantic,
right,
trying to give away his latest solo album. He's never been a solo superstar. He never will be. Yeah. The myth and the legend is Fleetwood Mac. It's all of them, yeah, collectively. And they fired him. He is dispensable.
Yeah.
They've replaced him with two new guitarists,
yeah,
Mike Campbell and Neil Finn. There was this constant creative and personal conflict. Obviously, he and Stevie Nicks had broken up. That was the point. That was why we loved Fleetwood Mac.
Mm.
That whole thing of Christine and John McVie and Lindsay and Stevie breaking up, yeah, rumors, the most wonderful breakup album of all time.
Yes.
We don't care about Lindsay on his own, do we?
No. Didn't he ruin Fleetwood Mac with Tusk? Because after Rumours came Tusk, and Tusk was dreadful, wasn't it? A bar
from, no, one, quite like Tusk.
No, but bar,
no, that's a good song, album. It's just not Rumours.
And apparently that was because Lindsay Buckingham's ego just erupted, and he said, "I'm laying down all the tracks and I'm playing all the great guitar solos and all that kind of stuff." And that was the end of Fleetwood Mac, I think.
He always thought it was about him.
Right.
But the thing is, it became about, primarily about Stevie Nicks.
Yeah.
But Stevie Nicks, she had a very successful solo career,
indeed,
of her own, by the way.
Indeed.
But we always loved her more as the face and the voice of Fleetwood Mac.
You certainly did.
And you'd have to say that Christine McVie's voice as well. You know, on Songbird, for example, that's another,
yeah,
famous Fleetwood Mac track from Rumours.
Yes.
She has the most exquisite voice.
Yeah.
And it's all about the voices and the faces.
Yes.
Could anybody pick out Lindsay Buckingham in a lineup?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I didn't even recognise his picture when I saw this review of his latest song, but there we are. Right, okay, Ms. Jones, thank you very much indeed. Thank you also to all our millions of listeners out there. Have a good week, folks. We'll be back with you again very soon. Ringo Starr takes credit for some of the Beatles' most famous songs. A Hard Day's Night, that was an expression I think he made to a taxi driver. 8 days a week, I think, was another one he made. And he used to come
Tomorrow
out...
Tomorrow Never Knows.
Tomorrow Never Knows, is that right? Good.
Because he came out with... His brain kind of didn't quite work in the conventional way.
Absolutely, so right.
He'd mean to say something and something else would come out of his mouth.
Yes, no, I think you're absolutely right. And then John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
Is that ringing any bells, Mike?
Ringing the bells for me, you mean? Well, most of the stuff that comes at my mouth out of my mouth doesn't make sense these days, but that's another story altogether, Miss Jones. This guy, believe it or not, ended up going out with Theo's daughter, and when we were in the boardroom at Millwall once, he was chairman of Millwall, and he used to talk through his teeth. He said, "Hi, Mike, how you doing? Everything all right? Everything all right?" He's of Greek ancestry, as you can probably tell. And I said, "Yeah." He said, "How's that lad of yours? He's shagging my daughter." I said,
"You don't know if you'd like the everything."
No, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, sounds great. Yeah, well, I must put that in my diary because that sounds wonderful. A bit of worship followed by a bit of the old blatteration. Yes, sounds brilliant.